The America Association of Colleges for Teacher Education presents the 54th Annual Meeting and Exhibits, recorded for AACTE in New York, New York in February of 2002. If you are listening to the audio tape format, at the end of side one, please stop the tape and turn to side two.
Welcome to the 2002 Kappa Delta Pi Lecture. I am Judy Nichols Mitchell, and I'm Dean of the College of Education at Washington State University, and I'm also a member of the Committee on Professional Development for AACTE. AACTE is pleased that Kappa Delta Pi has sponsored this general session at our annual meeting for a number of years. The speakers always bring a thought-provoking perspective to us. I'd like to introduce the Executive Director of Kappa Delta Pi, Dr. Michael Wolff.
Good afternoon. This afternoon's lecture has become an annual AACTE meeting highlight. Kappa Delta Pi has sponsored this lecture for many, many years. We are an international honor society of, about, and for educators. Founded in 1911 at the University of Illinois, Kappa Delta Pi was organized to reward and recognize excellence in education. It's the only honor society in America that's fully recognized by the Association of College Honor Societies. It elects those to membership who exhibit the ideals of scholarship, high personal standards, and promise in teaching and allied professions. We're an intergenerational group and diverse. We include undergraduate and graduate students, professors, K through 12 teachers, retirees, and honored educators. I wondered if all the people sitting in the room who are members of Kappa Delta Pi, or were initiated in Kappa Delta Pi, or have a chapter on your campus, to please rise and be recognized. Thank you, colleagues, for being here. I thought everyone would stand when I said that this was for high scholarship. This International Honor Society encourages improvement in practice, distinction, and contributions to education. I am very happy to represent the best and the brightest in our profession. And for those of you who support your local chapter counselors, we applaud those efforts. These are the unsung heroes of the chapter's way of producing leaders in our field. And all 56,000 active members of Kappa Delta Pi, thank you for that support on your local campus. And now to the 2002 Kappa Delta Pi lecturer. Alfie Cohen has been described by Time magazine as perhaps the country's most outspoken critic of education's fixation on grades and test scores. He speaks to many groups and conferences annually and has appeared on the Today Show and Oprah, among others. His most recent of 8 books is The Case Against Standardized Testing, Raising the Scores, Ruining the Schools. Cohen has contributed to publications ranging from Journal of Education, Harvard Business Review, Nation, Atlantic Monthly, Parents, and Psychology Today, where he is a contributing educator. Alfie Cohen is the author of 8 books as well as scores of articles on education and human behavior. Among those books is The Schools Our Children Deserve, Moving Beyond Traditional Classroom and Tougher Standards, which received the National Council of Teachers of English's George Orwell Award. Among his other books, No Contest, The Case Against Competition, published in 1986, Published by Rewards, published in 1993, and Beyond Discipline, published in 1996. which he describes as, quote, a modest attempt to overthrow the entire field of classroom management, unquote. Among Cohen's most recent articles are Beware the Standards, Not Just the Tests in Education Week, 5 Reasons to Stop Saying, quote, good job, unquote, in young children, and Burnt at the Stakes in the Journal of Teacher Education. Many of his writings, along with information about a nationwide grassroots movement to challenge the current overemphasis on standards and teachings, are available on his website, www.alfiecohen.org. I can't imagine a better person to represent Kappa Delta Pi at this annual lecture than Alfie Cohen. Please join me in welcoming our colleague.
Thank you.
Beginning.
Thank you. Thanks so much to Kappa Delta Pi and AACTE for having me here. I usually, in situations like this, like to begin with a joke, but we are very short on time today, so I'm going to have to skip right to the punchline. Rabbit? I thought you said rabbi. Okay. We are gathered on somewhat grim business, however, today. At least I am gathered on grim business to discuss the dimensions of what I think can properly be called an educational emergency in this country, largely as a result of the very accountability fad that claims to be saving us from an educational emergency. The overemphasis on testing children and on testing teacher candidates are two forms of testing that are, for the most part, parallel, with the possible exception of the unique harms of subjecting little kids to standardized tests. We find that the same critique applies to testing children and adults. I'll mention 4 aspects to begin with of what that critique might look like, which is not going to be news to most of you. First, there are equivalent or at least comparable problems with the kinds of tests that are often used. For example, multiple choice tests make no more sense for adults trying to get into the classroom than for kids trying to stay in the classroom. A multiple choice test cannot allow a test taker to generate an answer or even explain an answer. And as one educational measurement specialist explained to me recently, a multiple choice test is designed in large part to make sure that people who understand the material will nevertheless be tricked into picking the wrong answer. These tests often share the characteristic of being timed, as in you have 45 minutes to complete this section, which means that overwhelmingly what you're really testing is speed, not thoughtfulness. And of course, it's the case that these tests often share the characteristic of really asking the test taker to cough up forgettable facts and isolated skills that have been crammed into short-term memory. Despite the claims of ETS and others that they're really aiming higher than that, it is often just a matter, or at least in large part a matter, of something very much like rote recall. So the first thing that the tests share is the for kids and adults is that the characteristics of those tests are often objectionable. The second characteristic they share is that there are problems inherent to a one-shot, paper and pencil, standardized assessment, whether it's multiple choice or timed or not. As best as I can figure out, you need a standardized test for only one thing. That is to say, there is only one purpose served by a standardized test that cannot be served better and with fewer disadvantages by other forms of assessment. And that, the one thing that a standardized test does, is to create a giant contest where the point is to rank and sort people. The operative question, one might even say the driving question of a standardized test, is not how good is this person at teaching, how well has this person learned. Rather, the driving question is who's beating whom. If that question is not of interest to you because you're more interested in excellence than in victory, then as best as I can tell, there is no reason why you would need a one-shot, paper and pencil, standardized assessment, regardless of how it's been designed. The one thing that standardized tests presume to offer us is objectivity, which I think is clearly demonstrated to be a myth, a charade, except, of course, with tests in Great Britain, where, in fact, it is a charade instead. Just because it is a multiple-choice test does not mean that it is objective in any sense. People still had to make decisions about what went on the test and what would count and how much it would count for and so on. Indeed, one might even argue that in a field like education or in life in general, objectivity is a dangerous myth. Deborah Meyer recently said, "We trust fallible human judgment when it comes to deciding matters of great import, jury trials, selecting friends and spouses, deciding whether to go to war or not, but not when it comes to being promoted to fourth grade." We need to embrace the fact that objectivity is, in fact, an illusion rather than chasing it. And if you needed further evidence that it is an illusion, just look at the variation in cut scores with, say, the Praxis II exams, wildly varying from one state to the next. For example, in 35 states, you have to pass the Praxis II. Let's just, for no good reason, look at states whose names begin with M. If you happen to live in Minnesota or Mississippi, you need to get a 169 to pass the math. But if you live in Maryland, that's not good enough. You won't be able to teach even with a 176. You need a 177. And if you happen to live in Missouri, you don't need a math test at all because someone there has decided that the principles of learning test is sufficient. I'm not suggesting that people in localities and even individual states shouldn't be able to make these determinations on their own. I'm just saying we need to pay attention to this when anyone tells us that a standardized test is somehow more objective and therefore valuable as a criterion for deciding who gets to teach. So the second problem shared by standardized tests with kids and adults has to do with the very fact that they are standardized. The third concern has to do with the fact that everything often rests on a single measure. The National Research Council report released last spring says that licensure exams should never be the sole measure for who gets to teach in a classroom. And of course, something very similar in the way of high stakes is going on with who gets to be promoted to the next grade level, or indeed, who gets a diploma. Fourth, the tests share, or both sets of tests share, a similar rationale. They are the enforcement mechanism of a movement, an ideology about teaching and learning, which is about getting tough with teachers and with students, about standardizing the curriculum and centralizing authority. Standardized tests of the kinds we're talking about here and the kinds that children face were not proposed and defended by educators for educational reasons. We must never forget that they were proposed and imposed by politicians for political reasons. Part of that has to do with a heavy-handed, top-down system going under the name of accountability, a word that I could defend if I were allowed to define it, but which contextually has come to be nothing more than a code word for more control over what happens in classrooms by people who are not in classrooms. And it has approximately the same effect on learning that a noose has on breathing. Another word to look out for is the word, and this is my nominee for most Orwellian word in the current discourse, and that is alignment. When people talk about aligning your curriculum to a state document or a test, that is not an appeal to best practice, to research, or to theory. It is an appeal to naked power. When anyone talks about the need to align a curriculum, what they are talking about is not excellence, but conformity. And that is why I think that thoughtful educators, with every fiber of their being, must resist any appeals to align the curriculum, unless the change has been justified on its merits, rather than because you have to do it or else. I am not an educational historian, so take this next generalization with a grain of salt, but as far as I can tell from having read what's happened earlier in this country, I would say that the current accountability and standards movement has a good claim to being the most profoundly undemocratic movement in the history of American education. And that is true at the level of teacher education as well as in the classroom. What else besides accountability and top-down control do we find characteristic of the rationale underlying both sorts of tests? Well, a mania for quantification. If you can't reduce it to numbers, it isn't real, scientific, valid, reliable, or important. If you can reduce it to numbers, then it's something worth doing. Linda McNeil, professor at Rice University in Houston, put it very well with a phrase that leapt off the page when I first read it in a book of hers more than 15 years ago. Measurable outcomes, she said, may be the least significant results of learning. That's the kind of statement that ought to be printed up in 42-point Helvetica, framed, and posted in every dean's office, every superintendent's office around the country. Measurable outcomes may be the least significant results of learning. But this whole mania here for reducing things to numbers trivializes that which we're doing. If you want an example to share with your neighbor who's not in the field of education, remind him or her that it is a hell of a lot easier to quantify the number of semicolons used correctly in a student's essay than it is to quantify the number of wonderful ideas contained in that essay. To that extent, the more pressure there is for measurable standards, the more trivialized the teaching will tend to become. And then, closely connected to this, is the notion that improvement in schools consists primarily of making things harder. I wish I could be accused of oversimplifying, exaggerating, creating a straw man here, but it is literally true, and I have many more examples than I have occasion or time here to cite, of how the people behind this tougher standards movement literally seem to believe that something is more worthwhile if it is harder, and that is the correct way to measure tests as well as texts and teachers and classrooms. We have to raise the bar, another of my favorite expressions, and one, incidentally, that I'm reasonably certain originated in the world of show horses, which may tell us everything we need to know about the view of children on the part of people who talk this way. To judge a classroom or a program of education or a school district on the basis of whether we have raised the bar and created sufficient rigor is like judging an opera on the basis of how many notes it contains that are really hard for the singers to hit. In other words, it misses most of what matters. I have only one example to offer to you today from the Commissioner of Education for a Western state. I need not name the state. It could be any state with a mile-high city in it. This commissioner said, and I quote, now listen carefully to this, because as Dave Barry would say, we are not making this up. Unless you get bad results, it is highly doubtful you have done anything useful with your tests. Low scores have become synonymous with good tests, unquote. This is the kind of comment that threatens to make satire obsolete. But it is in fact driving this entire movement. The whole debate, where you live and where I live, is focused on cutoff scores, not on the value or validity of the test. And improvement, by definition, consists of raising those scores. So, for example, in Illinois now, they're in the process of raising the scores so fewer people will be allowed to teach in classrooms at a time when that state is facing a drastic shortage of teachers. Some states apply this mindless macho philosophy to the point of self-parody, like Virginia, which has declared it will have the highest required Praxis scores in the U.S. You raise your scores, we'll raise them some more. And it's all sold to the public, successfully in many cases, that's the horror, in the name of raising standards. Before I leave this point, Deborah Meyer and I have dinner periodically and play a game called, let's see if we can figure out what this standards movement is really about before the dessert arrives. Some months ago, we happened upon a deeply disturbing possibility that I always like to put forward to audiences in the form of a thought experiment. And I get the same answer to my question wherever I go. Here it is. Imagine that the high school test, it could even be applied to the question of a Praxis exam or similar licensure test. But imagine, say, a high school test in your state is applied and then passed by virtually every student who takes the test. Almost everybody meets the standard. What is the likely response going to be from the State Board of Education, the governor, your newspaper, and others? What's that? Damn, these teachers are good? So unlikely as to be downright laughable. The response everybody says that they would expect would be something like, the test was too easy, the standards were too low, we have to raise the bar. If you think that's true, then I ask you simply logically to reflect on what that means. And as far as I can tell, what it means is that when they talk about higher standards, what they evidently mean are standards that all children will never be able to meet. Because if everyone was able to meet those standards, that would be prima facie evidence that the standards were too low and had to be ratcheted upward until we ensured failure, suggesting that if you peer through the fog of rhetoric about standards and accountability, what you are looking at is a giant sorting machine. And that is a characteristic, again, shared by both exams for students and exams for teachers. Now, there are some aspects of this that apply to teacher testing in particular, namely the question of what are we testing? And specifically, remember there are two separable issues here. One is, should we be judging teachers mostly on content-based knowledge as opposed to pedagogical skills, the ability to help children learn, whatever their field, and so on? And then that's separate from the question of whatever it is we're judging, is a standardized test a good way to do it? We have to keep those two things separate because there's different things to be said about each. Now, the NRC report that came out last spring from that prestigious research council faulted the system for relying, quote, almost exclusively on content-related evidence. Many of you are familiar with this debate, which has become quite polarized. Many of you have read or heard, say, an exchange between Checker Finn and Linda Darling Hammond and other representatives for different versions of whether teachers ought to be seen as professionalized and what criteria are used. To minimize the significance of pedagogy and to maximize the emphasis on content is, of course, to make a political argument about who gets to be a teacher and who gets to decide who gets to be a teacher. But it also is to make a pedagogical argument in itself. The argument seems to be that teaching consists of the transmission of information to passive receptacles and that learning consists of the absorption in a passive way of that. After all, if learning were a process of constructing knowledge in an active way, then you might need some special skills in the classroom to make that happen. So if you are focusing on content-related knowledge, anybody who knows this much about math ought to be a teacher, you are making an argument about what the whole process of teaching consists of, even if you're not owning up to making that argument. Cognitive science, as many of you know, does not support that transmission-oriented approach. People across the spectrum have had to concede, based on what we know now in the last few decades in particular, about how learning takes place, that learning is a process of actively constructing, of reorienting, reconceptualizing one's theories, whether one is 2 years old or 80 years old. So that suggests that the more familiar you are with the research on how learning takes place, the less likely you would be to define teacher qualification mostly in terms of how much information they have at their disposal about literature or science or whatever. Years ago, for 7 years running, in fact, I taught a course on existentialism. I loved this course. And I thought of myself, frankly, as being rather good in the classroom. I was the kind of teacher kids seemed to like and their parents seemed to like. I loved the field. I would try hard to polish up my syllabus in between the terms when I offered the course to keep up with the latest news about existentialism, I guess. and I cared about kids, and I was an entertaining lecturer and so on, and it wasn't for years that I realized that I was, in important respects, not a very good teacher, because that course was all about me. The syllabus was prepared before I met any of the kids, which is a sure sign that something's wrong, because they are treated as interchangeable open bird beaks. And I was offering them Nietzschean worms, or I think we will drop this metaphor abruptly. The second step in this argument, though, about how when you follow the latest understanding about how learning happens, the less likely you would be to endorse a primarily content-oriented approach to teacher qualification, the next step would be, you know, almost everybody, even people who are quite conservative on these questions of professionalization, would have to acknowledge that a standardized pencil and paper test is not the best way to determine how well teachers are able to help people construct knowledge. Even if they think standardized tests are great for finding out how much you know about literature or history, they're not that great at figuring out who's terrific in the classroom. So if you put all of this stuff together in one sort of giant subversive syllabus, you end up with the conclusion that standardized tests are uniquely inadequate at judging what is most important about who's going to be good in the classroom. Nevertheless, we find ourselves in a situation where things are getting worse. 43 states now require standardized tests for certification. In April of this year, state-by-state report cards on teacher preparation programs, as you know, all too painfully, will be released by the federal government, not only rating, but creating a forced ranking. Once again, not about excellence, but about victory, so it becomes a high-stakes process for schools of education as well as for individuals. Federal funding may hinge on passing rates. And of course, that creates powerful pressure to what? Teach better? No. Fiddle around with the data until you get the passing rates you think you need. So for example, state colleges in Massachusetts are now requiring students to pass their certification test before they do their student teaching. The result, mirabile dictu, a 100% pass rate for students completing the program. This is the sort of games playing that would be funny if it weren't for the fact that we are, of course, placing the burden on the teacher candidates, and really, to use the technical psychometric term, screwing them over. Other states are moving in the wrong direction at lightning speed as well. Massachusetts is joined by North Carolina in phasing in testing for people who are already licensed teachers if they happen to be in low-performing schools. That is, they've made the unfortunate choice of teaching in poor neighborhoods, so obviously the teachers have to be checked again, like a car every few years being checked for its exhaust pipe. And that's another metaphor that really doesn't work very well now that I think about it. Pennsylvania now is about to become the first state in the country to force all teachers currently in the classrooms to submit to more testing. The state managed to buy off the union's opposition with a pension hike. The cost, $7.5 million, and an enormous investment of time. What else is happening? Still more teacher tests being prepared. You may have heard about a group called the Education Leaders Council, which was formed by state school superintendents and commissioners too conservative to allow themselves to be in the CCSSO, the Council of Chief State Schools Officers. So the Conservative Education Leaders Council is joining forces with Checker Finn's Fordham Foundation to set up a new group called the American Board for Certification of Teacher Excellence to create just what we need, more teacher tests. Their motives for this, first of all, we're going to make these tests more rigorous than the existing ones. And second, we're going to make sure that we can license prospective teachers who don't attend schools of education, thereby, in the name of excellence and rigor, powerfully undermining the existing schools of education for ideological reasons. This group, with this proposal that I think many people in the field would find, shall we say, dubious, was instantly awarded a $5 million grant by the U.S. Department of Education. Why? Well, I don't know, but I do know. I do know that Eugene Hickok, our new Undersecretary of Education, was the co-founder of the ELC, and that Rod Page, our new Secretary of Education, spoke at the Conservative ELC conference last fall and told them they were doing, quote, God's work. By the way, who is the new chair of the ELC, the Education Leaders Council? It is none other than Bill Maloney, the commissioner of Colorado, who said that almost a self-parroting comment about tests are better if they are harder and so on. So what are the effects of this depressing litany of evidence that we are mandating more in the way of testing? Well, the first and most obvious effect is that we are making teaching gradually less and less a diverse profession. Between 1993 and 1997, the percentage of America's teachers who are African American dropped from 9% to 7%. And when you look at the Praxis results, you see that that is going to, again, if you can extrapolate, drop some more. Praxis 2 is passed by 91% of whites and 69% of African Americans, at least in the mid-1990s. Comparable disparity in Praxis 1. But please don't let anyone ever in your presence frame this as a trade-off between excellence and equity, or between merit and diversity, because this is not about excellence or merit, it's about high standardized test scores. And that is a very important and often overlooked distinction. The second obvious impact of all of this, as many of you know more painfully than I do, is that we are keeping out qualified teachers because of a limit of standardized testing at a time of a teacher shortage. And there are many examples of this where obviously very qualified and motivated teacher candidates don't get whatever that state happened to arbitrarily set as the passing rate, the proficiency level, the cut score, and are forced to find another profession. Who knows? It may even have the converse, or possibly inverse error, I can never keep those two straight, in which we are letting in some people who ought not to be teaching because they happen to be very good at taking standardized tests. In any case, we are certainly changing the pool for the worse the more we emphasize standardized testing and standardized testing of content knowledge as the primary gatekeeper. The third effect is that we are warping the curriculum at schools of education. It is, of course, terribly time-consuming for people like you to be having meetings, not to improve what you're doing, but to align the curriculum to the exams, to study the test frameworks instead of the research on pedagogy, to take up student time in field placement classrooms with practice tests and reviews, and to have instructors get positive reinforcement who do more direct instruction that turns a school of education into a giant test prep center. That is nothing short of an educational tragedy, and as you know, creates an excruciating dilemma in which people have to choose every day of their lives professionally. Are we going to do what is best for helping prepare good teachers, or are we going to do what is best for allowing them to pass the licensure exams? And I cannot italicize that word "or" too strongly. After this session, for those of you who would like to stay, we're going to have a breakout session, not only for conventional Q&A, but for what I hope will be a kind of brainstorming session to talk about ways to deal with that dilemma in ways that are constructive, or at least minimize the harm and allow ourselves to still look at ourselves in the mirror. The fourth effect of this rush to testing is that we are teaching these teacher candidates with the test itself. And this is not always recognized. The bunch of facts approach and the appropriateness or even inevitability of standardized testing in places that are supposed to be about learning may be the real lessons that they learn as a result of these tests. And will be tempted then to apply this to their own students when they find themselves in the classroom. Some of your students find themselves being challenged for the first time in their lives to rethink traditional intuitive assumptions about teaching and learning. Most of us in this culture have been taught implicitly, if not explicitly, to assume that teaching is a process whereby The teacher has a bunch of stuff and transmits it to the open receptacles of the students. Many of you are doing your damnedest to help these future teachers understand that that is not necessarily good teaching, or at least not the only model by which education takes place. You are doing what Rod Page might have called God's work, to the extent you are opening their minds to rethinking those traditional assumptions. And then, having learned from you about authentic assessment, about student-centered, understanding-based teaching, they now are plunged back into what they had assumed was true all along, based on the kind of test they themselves are forced to take. And you have to ask yourself, or at least I do, in my darker moments, whether this is part of the whole point of teacher testing. Not merely to raise the bar, not merely to reduce everything to numbers, but to wipe out challenges to traditional teaching by the implicit message of these tests. You know about the alternatives. It would be an interesting conversation, perhaps, to talk about how there are parallels between authentic assessment done with little kids in elementary school and authentic assessment whereby teacher candidates can demonstrate what they know and can do in more authentic and meaningful formats. But we have to think about the situation in which we find ourselves and moving on several tracks at once in order to deal with this. The first response is a short-term response of minimizing the damage. So long as we are praxised to death, what can we do in our schools of education, in our teacher ed programs, to minimize the impact of those tests and preserve large pockets of good teaching and good teaching about teaching? How do we make as little concession as possible to these damn things? Second, though, and never to be forgotten, because we get carried away with that first interim stopgap measure, is a long-term response of what can we do to become politically organized to challenge this standardization of teacher preparation. Because if we forget that second step and content ourselves only with doing as much as we can within the current structure, then our teachers' students, when they decide to become teachers, will face the same kind of standardized, top-down, heavy-handed, corporate-styled, traditionalist approaches. And that's why we must work to change the system, not only to work within it. Third, and this is what I want to spend the rest of my brief time with you discussing, beyond our response to the testing itself, we need to see this as an invitation to reflect on broader issues having to do with what our schools of education are all about and how we conceive of our task and our mission. Do you ever look at parenting magazines? I don't know if you subscribe to them or see them on the newsstand. The two most popular are Parents and Parenting. And the one thing that dawned on me after having read these periodically and occasionally even written for them, which is quite an experience, given that I compose my articles on a word processor only to see them edited on a food processor. But the main thing I notice about the articles, issue after issue, is that they are not just trying to teach parents how to socialize their kids. They are about the enterprising of socializing parents. And specifically, they're about socializing parents to accept the status quo. So for example, you will find articles in them about helping your kid to be a good sport on the playing field, or learn how to compete in a way that is fair and effective in the classroom. You will not find an article raising questions about the value or inevitability of competition. You will find articles in parenting magazines about helping your kids get good grades, or wrestling with the issue of how much to help your kid with his or her homework. You will not find articles asking whether the homework is worth doing and what parents, if they were organized, could do to move toward a more legitimate and engaging curriculum. These magazines are all about, at the end of the day, as they say, dealing with reality as we find it. I don't know why I picked the example of parenting magazines, because there are any number of other things in our culture of which the same could be said. Our question, my question, is, are schools of education in some respects functioning like those parenting magazines to deal with reality as we find it? Are we turning out teachers who will accept and perpetuate the status quo, or those who will ask radical questions? I have no problem with the adjective radical here, because I know that its Latin root is root. A radical question is a root question that doesn't ask what should the cut score be, but why should standardized tests be used at all, and so on. Those radical questions are the ones that keep the status quo honest and have our eye on more than just how are we going to succeed within someone else's confines and parameters. Noam Chomsky put it very well. The smart way to keep people passive and obedient, he said, is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum. Even encourage the more critical and dissident views. That gives people the sense that there's free thinking going on, while all the time, the presuppositions of the system are being reinforced by the limits put on the range of the debate. About how many questions in education could we say the same? Are we doing all we can to help our teacher candidates, our students, to at least minimize the impact of what is destructive about K-12 education? And equally important, to resist that when they get in the classroom. If we don't, we end up with a few brave souls all on their own having to stand up. I got a letter in the mail from a teacher candidate with unconventional qualifications. Wanted to be a teacher, decided in later life, Phi Beta Kappa, Oberlin College, received a PhD in classics, translated some Euripides, quite an extraordinary young man, who wrote a letter at his school of education to the dean saying, quote, I will not be taking the pre-professional skills test this fall. This may mean that you will deny me formal admission to the education department, but I object to the use and question the validity of the PPST or any standardized test as an assessment tool. I would rather devote my energy to lobbying against the inflexible use of this test. You may be aware of the growing body of research calling into question the merits of standardized testing. And he goes on to say that he's sure, based on his experience, he would not have trouble passing it, but that he objects to and will not participate in a process that he believes is unfair. And I say, where are the others? Or there's the fellow in my state of Massachusetts, Jim Bugas, a 28-year veteran, 30 years now, social studies teacher, who refused not only to teach to the test given to his middle school students, but at some point an inconvenient question occurred to him that he probably wishes had never occurred to him. If I cannot in good conscience teach to the test, how can I hand out the test? How can I break the shrink wrap and become the accomplice of people who know a hell of a lot less about learning than I do? And he insisted on being assigned to library duty the week that the tests were given out in the spring of 99, which he did, and a nasty note was placed in his personnel file reminding him never to do this again. But the next year, he realized the test hadn't changed and his response couldn't either, even when he was denied library duty or an unpaid leave and told to show up because it was his job. He said, you've already taken my job away from me if I'm a test prep technician. Fire me if you have to. He was not fired, nor was a fellow in Colorado who did the same thing. But these are examples we tick off on the fingers of one hand, and it may not just be because of a lack of courage on the part of teachers or teacher candidates, but maybe in teacher education programs, we could be doing more to raise these issues so these brave souls have a lot of company. Why are there methods courses, but no goals courses? What is the purpose of education and of educating future educators? What do you want your students to come out with? Well, presumably with skills, with enthusiasm, with knowledge about their subject matter, yes, with knowledge and a growing passion for and competence at teaching itself, maybe even some nuts and bolts about how to navigate your way through the system. But at least for me, I cannot speak for you, only to you, I would hope that teacher candidates come out of your program with a sense of outrage when that is what is required by the situation in which they find themselves. What Hemingway famously called a crap detector. Is that not as important a goal as subject matter knowledge when they are faced with words like alignment? I would like them to come out with a collaborative orientation so that they actively resist attempts to isolate them, so that when they are asked to do unfathomable things, when they are told to hand out worksheets, run lecture-based, textbook-driven lessons, and spend time giving kids practice tests, that they will not merely slam their door and whine about it over white wine on Friday afternoons with their friends, but they will reach out to their colleagues to say, we must not let this pass, and begin organizing in response to perceived injustices. I hope that they come out of your programs with the belief that one can and must fight what's wrong, as well as having knowledge about not only how to teach, but how to fight when that is appropriate. If those are our goals, or at least those make sense to many of you here, then my respectful but pointed challenge to you is to ask whether your curriculum and the way your schools of education are organized are really about reaching those goals, helping these future teachers to have the immediate response of organizing to fight injustices, as opposed to just gaming the system or putting their heads down and waiting for this too to pass. Short of helping students to engage in long-term strategies to organize against and change bad systems, it would be an improvement even to have them work to minimize the damage, but first they have to see that this accountability fad is damaging. And remember that their ultimate obligation is to the kids. Not to raise scores, not to maintain order, not to please the administrators. Does your program teach this every week, that their ultimate obligation is to the students, and not just as a pleasant, vapid... Thank you. But many of them use traditional transmission methods to get across their ideas about liberatory praxis or patriarchal hegemony or commodifying discourse. Their syllabuses were prepared before they met the kids too. And some of them work largely by fishing for the answers they're looking for and by lecturing and by giving grades. That's the lesson their students learn. It's not about hegemony. It's about, this is what a classroom is supposed to look like. This guy may be talking from the port side of the spectrum, but what I am learning every day is I have to learn this stuff for a test, and I'm supposed to listen and give him back his rhetoric. That's what they'll learn. It's even more ironic, though, when the lesson isn't just about social change, but it's specifically about constructivism. Who put it best? Same guy, John Dewey. 1916, could have been this morning. Quote, why is it, in spite of the fact that teaching by pouring in, learning by a passive absorption, are universally condemned, that they are still so entrenched in practice? That education is not an affair of telling and being told, but an active and constructive process, is a principle almost as generally violated in practice as conceded in theory. Is not this deplorable situation due to the fact
that the doctrine is itself merely told. It is preached, it is lectured, it is written about, but its enactment into practice requires that the school environment be equipped with agencies for doing. And that surely includes the educational environment. Several years later, Dewey added that, quote, to train teachers in the right principles, but the wrong way, is an improvement over teacher training that's wrong in both respects, but it's not much of an improvement. It's about as funny as Dewey got. But it does raise challenging and important questions about the whole notion of lecturing about constructivism, or telling students in an instructor-based classroom about the need to create student-based classrooms. That pedagogical aspect of, are we doing what we would hope we would be doing? There are many of you who are living counterexamples of this, who in fact embody this notion of creating a classroom environment where explicitly and implicitly the outright curriculum and the hidden curriculum join together to help kids not only fight injustices, but have a sense, a taste of what it means to really teach in that way. We're still fighting an uphill battle. Elsewhere, Dewey said that we don't teach the way we were taught to teach, we teach the way we were taught. And a lot of people were teaching them a different way before they got to your rooms. But nevertheless, are we doing all we could? Some folks clearly are. I keep reading and hearing about and seeing examples that inspire me. If you have ever heard of, let alone seen in practice, Eleanor Duckworth's classroom at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, you know that you will be constructing your own understanding for weeks about how the moon works, not just reading Dewey or Piaget, and you will come out humbled as well as with a sense of what it means to be the learner that you will never forget. If you're a student in Jeff Golub's classroom at the University of South Florida, then you know you not only have to spend time observing in classrooms, but your assignment will be to bring in evidence concerning whether learning is taking place in those classrooms you're watching. And don't try asking him, what does learning mean? Because that's the whole point. You have to construct that knowledge yourself. And they argue heatedly about not only defining the term, but thinking about what it means for us when we're the ones in the classroom. If you're a student at Western Carolina University in Lisa Bloom's classroom, you know that you were given a list of the state competencies, and then you were required to set them in an order of priority and to supplement them, to pick out what's missing, to think about how to meet this stuff. You know that the course requirements in her course were up to you with your fellow students to devise. Individual reading assignments, individual and group projects, leading class discussions, and so on. There are many more examples, and I don't want to insult anyone by omission because your example should have been listed next. I just don't know about it yet. But these are folks who are rebelling every day against the Bunch O' Facts test prep model, not only by what they teach students about those issues, but about how they teach all the time. The excruciating dilemma is how to teach them in a way that makes sense at the same time that we don't in the short term handicap these students by causing them to be run over by the praxis train. That's what I want to work with you about in 15 minutes to see if we can figure out different ways to overcome. But what we don't want to see is a situation where we throw up our hands and treat the current testing mania or accountability fad as just part of life. These tests are not like the weather. They're not something to which you must simply accommodate or acclimate yourself. Rather, they represent political decisions. And like all political decisions, they can be questioned and challenged and ultimately overcome. That at least must be part of our job if we too see ultimately the people to whom we are responsible as children. This may require some of us to look at our own teaching. not only in the field of education, but throughout academia, I can name an embarrassing number of people who see themselves as true critical thinkers, as progressive-minded critics of the status quo. Some of them quite